30 minutes past 12 o'clock, you're listening to KVSC's News Watch program. I'm KVSC alumni Fareed Gio. U.S. astronaut Clay Anderson has been around the world before. In fact, in 2007, he circled the Earth for more than 5 months aboard the International Space Station as a flight engineer and science officer on International Space Station Expedition 15. Mr. Anderson is a veteran of two space flights. He has logged 167 days in space and 38 hours and 28 minutes of EVA, or extravehicular activity, in six spacewalks. In addition to his time aboard the space station, he served as a mission specialist aboard Space Shuttle Discovery as part of the STS-131 crew in 2010. Clay Anderson is a native of Nebraska, retired from NASA just last month after 30 years. Mr. Anderson, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon.
And where are you calling us from right now?
Right now I'm in, Houston, Texas, but it's actually a place called Clear Lake City.
And most people who join the space program, do they move to Houston or the Houston area?
Yes, all of the astronauts are residents of Houston or Southeast Houston, because that's their primary residence and where we do most of our training. So when you become an astronaut or selected as an astronaut, one of the requirements is you must move to Houston, Texas.
Well, you're a native of when an astronaut does go into retirement after, you know, spending 30 years crossing off that big thing on the bucket list, it's probably, you know, what do you do now?
That's a really good question. Right now I'm in a period of what I call discovery. I'm going to finish writing the book I started a few years ago, and I hope to finish that by the end of the year. And then I'm also doing public speaking engagements. I'm trying to set up as many of those as I can. And then I'm also going to do some small consulting work. Right now I've got a couple trips to the Midwest to work with teachers at the University of Nebraska and work with the Aerospace Engineering Department at Iowa State University.
And can you give us a hint? Is it a fiction, nonfiction book?
It's nonfiction, and it will be essentially a memoir of my time from the time I applied to be an astronaut through the time I was selected, trained, flew, and came home. That's the current goal, and then, you know, once I start talking to folks that know how to do books and edit and that sort of thing, the content may change a little bit, but that's the going-in plan.
And then after that, maybe that space murder mystery you've been always wanting to write about.
Actually, you know, that's funny that you would say that. I have a good friend, Nevada Barr, who's a mystery writer with Anna Pigeon, the Anna Pigeon series, and she's been encouraging me to try to write both a children's book and a fiction book. So that may be down the road, but we'll just have to see how successful this first one is. It's one of those deals where I needed to write what I felt most comfortable about first, and of course, that's my career. And then we'll see if that one gets some good reviews and good support, we'll see what comes next.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. Writing is always challenging to do, so we wish you the best of luck. When you joined NASA in 1983, what were your plans at the time?
Well, my plans were to simply be the best engineer that I could be for NASA, working for the greatest space program in the world. And, you know, I had aspirations to become an astronaut, but in reality, I knew that the odds were pretty daunting. So the fact that I was working in Houston for NASA with astronauts was pretty much what I wanted to achieve, and anything else after that was going to be frosting on the cake.
Talk about some of the years that you spent at NASA before being selected to be an astronaut. You know, they do a lot of things other than go into space. From what I read about you, you were in mission support for many years before you were selected for the astronaut program.
Right. As a young engineer here, you know, there was no space station, and the space shuttle program was in its infancy. So one of my original jobs was to take some of the space station designs. There were several, at least four at the time. And then our trajectory design group then would do computer analysis and trajectory analysis to see how many shuttles we could dock at a station at any one time. You know, could we dock two? Could we dock three? You know, back then the sky was the limit, so the idea of developing space stations and capability that would work with all four shuttles was the goal. So it was pretty exciting work.
And what were some of the design challenges that you encountered when designing a living space in space?
Well, you know, the old designs of the space station were even bigger than what's actually up there now flying around the Earth. And the fact that they were so massive allowed you the opportunity to dock several shuttles there at one time, and to perhaps bring in other visiting vehicles. We had bays where we could work on satellites, and the astronauts could go out in, on spacewalks and do repairs to the satellites that were brought in. So there were all sorts of challenges, like how do you keep it stable in space? How do you rendezvous with it? How do you get astronauts out there to do the technical work? And it was just, it was so, such a big vision and a big dream that there was a lot of different things to analyze.
And, you know, something like this is such a big design program, and you probably worked on one specific area. How do you keep perspective when you're working on this little itty-bitty part of such a massive project that, you know, takes so many people and parts just to get up into orbit?
Well, I think that throughout your time, you know, even though it's a big project, the folks working on it were relatively contained here in a smaller group at NASA, so... oftentimes the meetings we would go to while there, we were waiting for our specific piece to be discussed, we had the ability to listen to other people discussing with the same management folks their small piece of the pie. So if you were astute and paid attention, you could learn a lot about what other folks were working on and the problems that they were encountering, just waiting for your turn to present your data and information.
So being an astronaut probably is pretty challenging. Is the selection process harder?
Well, you know, the selection process, I imagine it's pretty difficult for the folks that are choosing. If you're a candidate that wants to be an astronaut, it's pretty simple. You just show up and go where they tell you. You do the medical tests, you take the exams, you do the interviews. You know, it's by that time, it's you're who you are, and not a whole lot of that is going to change, so... It becomes one of those deals where I think the hardest job is for the folks that are doing the selecting, not the people that want to be selected.
What are some of the key qualifications? I mean, how many pull-ups am I supposed to be able to do in order to become an astronaut?
Well, you have to have at least a bachelor's degree in a physical science, and then advanced degrees are preferred, or you can be a military jet pilot with test pilot experience. You know, there are basic requirements for size. You can, you know, be between 5 foot even and 6'4". You have to have decent vision that's correctable to 20/20. You can't have any serious medical problems like a previous kidney stone or heart disease or anything like that. But essentially, it's kind of wide open. If you have a technical degree and you're in pretty good health, you should go for it.
In the Mercury program, of course, the U.S. was learning how to make astronauts, and it was learning how to develop a space program, at least the human part of a space program. And, of course, astronauts have evolved since then. We've even studied older people in space, like astronaut John Glenn, who went up when he was a young man and, of course, is being the oldest person in space. How robust is the human body for space travel? What have we learned about that?
Well, I think we've discovered that the human body is hugely adaptable. You know, the ability to go from a one gravity, one G environment to a micro G environment. The body adapts very quickly in less than a day or two. It's able to then allow the human body to work in zero G for months at a time and then come back and quickly readapt to gravity on Earth. So we've learned about how to stay in shape, how to keep our bones and muscles strong in space, such that when we do return to Earth, we don't experience brittle bones and injuries. And we've also figured out ways to enhance sleep for both people in space and on the ground. Lots of great data has been gathered by the folks looking at the physiological aspects of space travel.
And now, looking back at your career, now obviously you've retired as an astronaut, but what else would you have wanted to do as an astronaut in the space program?
Well, I would have loved to have gone back into space. The difficulty there, though, is that the tax that you have to pay with your family is pretty high. It would have required 2 to 3 more years of training overseas and travel and, you know, a lot of stress that I really didn't know if I wanted to accept. I would have loved to have been a leader in the astronaut corps, but that was not presented to me as a possibility. So I have a lot to accomplish in my life after being an astronaut. I think there are some special things waiting for me So it was a good opportunity when NASA offered early retirement for me to leave and pursue other interests.
I'm speaking with U.S. astronaut Clay Anderson, just retired last month, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to KVSC.
How about the 12th? Is that free? Nope, you have a meeting with corporate at 10 a.m. and a lunch date with the Monroe clients. What about the 19th? Nope, you're scheduled for a dentist appointment, and you leave for a vacation on the 29th, so I think that leaves you with the 22nd. Okay, should I put you down for the flu then?
You can't schedule the flu into your life, so schedule your vaccine now. Visit mdhflu.com for information on how to get your flu shot. Sponsored by the Minnesota Department of Health, aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to KVSC St. Cloud 1241 on KVSC's Newswatch program. I'm Fareed Guillot, and on the phone with me is U.S. astronaut retired Clay Anderson. Thanks so much again for joining us this afternoon as we lead into Trivia 2013, A Space Oddity. We'll talk about that in just a second, because I'm sure you've got lots of questions for us about exactly how you got roped into this ridiculous contest that we have here. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the space program. You have been a space station. You've served on a space station for 5 months, and you also did participate in a later shuttle mission. What makes the space station so essential? I mean, you helped build it when you during your time up there.
Right. I think that what the station does for humanity is it provides us a laboratory base in a micro-G environment. And, you know, imagine building a new laboratory on Earth, right? You spend a lot of time constructing the facility, but then the real work starts when you begin to utilize that facility and try to figure out what you need to do and to get results. And that's one of the things we're looking at. You know, the human body in space and how you live and work in a micro-G environment or on another planet, all those things are things that we have to learn how to do. And the space station is offering us a template, if you will, to how to do some of those things. And I think the most important idea right now on the station is to do studies in human anatomy and physiology, which hopefully will help benefit folks back here on Earth.
What does the space station teach us? You kind of maybe answered this a little bit before with my other question, but what does it teach us about humans in space, maybe behaviorally and so on?
Well, I think that's behaviorally and psychologically, that's one of the areas that we need to work on. You know, 6 months in space is pretty easy to do. We're going to send Scott Kelly back into space for a year-long mission here in a little over 18 months or so. And that's going to give us a better idea of how the human body can adapt psychologically over a longer period of time, which is what it's going to take to get to the planet Mars, for example. But the other things we look at that are critical to folks on Earth are we analyze how the blood pressure and how the heart work in zero-G versus the gravity environment on Earth. We look at how the brain adapts and how muscles adapt so that we're looking for ways to get stronger bones, stronger blood pressure systems, those sort of things that will help perhaps the elderly back here on Earth. So anything we do with the tax dollars, I always look for the ramification of how that's going to benefit the folks on Earth.
And it is an international space station. Did you serve with people from other space programs and other countries while you were up there?
Absolutely. My first time I lived with two Russians, Oleg Kotov and Fyodor Yurchikhin, on board the station. I also spent time with a young man from Malaysia, and while he visited the space station for about 8 days, and then I also had another Russian, Yuri Malenchenko, who was up there. And then when I went back to space, in addition to the Russian colleagues that were there, I also flew with two folks from Japan and the Japanese agency, which was very cool.
And I don't know, could you wrap your head around the fact that people are like coming and going to this very remote outpost, and we're not talking remote outposts like Wyoming or Alaska or something like that. We're talking about in a very dangerous place where, you know, if something fails, everybody is in trouble.
Well, I think, you know, for an astronaut, it's very similar to going to Antarctica or to traveling down to the Aquarius habitat off of Key Largo, Florida. You know, those are both pretty unforgiving environments as well, and that's one of the ways they train astronauts for the space station is to put them in those other environments because they're closer, a little bit cheaper, and you can do them more frequently. So extreme environments exist in a lot of places, and that's one of the challenges that folks like to do is challenge those extreme environments and try to be successful.
You mentioned extreme environments, and I was talking to someone yesterday who knows a lot about the space program. And is it true that you did some underwater research as well?
Right. I lived at the Aquarius Habitat with the National Undersea Research Center. At that time, it was out of Wilmington, North Carolina, and we spent 2 weeks underwater on the Aquarius Habitat, working in, as if we were a space station crew to try to see how that analogy could help benefit us in space.
That is fascinating. So a lot of people don't know that there is a habitat underwater, and Roy Scheider, I think, would be very excited about this, probably.
Yeah, about 62 feet below the surface.
Oh, interesting. Can you hear noises? You probably can hear noises, but, I mean, what noises did you get used to hearing from above, if anything?
Well, when we lived underwater, you heard, I guess they're called crackling shrimp that would make noise on the outside of the habitat on a shell, and you would hear that at night when you went to sleep. And of course, you always hear fan noise and the equipment that's running while you're there. But it's nothing that's unobtrusive or it's not that dissimilar to what you hear on the International Space Station.
Okay, I was just going to ask, is the vacuum of space supposedly not as much chance for sound waves to move around, except with inside the environment that you're existing. I wanted to talk a little bit. You mentioned your Russian colleagues, especially. What started out as a rivalry back in the 50s and 60s as far as space travel, it now has become a partnership. What do the Russians do really well at space and space travel, space program, et cetera?
Well, I think the Russians are very smart and capable people, and they, if it's not broken, they don't worry about it, right? If they're very good at using the technology that has worked for them for years, and if it still works and it's still functional and it still gets the job done, then that's what they stay with. Maybe they're coming around a little bit in the world of computers and upgrading some of their software capabilities, but you know, for the most part, they're pretty sharp folks, and if they can do it with a manual valve and a manual switch, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to try to manipulate it via a computer, which is what the United States likes to do.
Right, is that old joke that may be a myth about the space pen versus the space pencil kind of thing, and that's the philosophy they have employed, you would agree?
Yeah, I think so. You know, from what I've observed, but they're very safety conscious, they're very efficient, efficiency conscience, so they do the right thing. They just do it in a little different way than we do.
Let's talk a little bit more about some golly gee whiz stuff that maybe happens aboard the space station, because you are up in this enclosed place. What kind of games can be played? You can't play cards necessarily. Maybe you can. Maybe it's just it has to be done a different way. But what are some of the things that are done to pass the time?
Well, you know, I know that there was one gentleman that played chess with the ground, and, you know, you just need a little Velcro for some of these games like cards and solitaire, but I played some computer golf, tried that. I didn't really enjoy it that much, but I like to play sports like baseball and basketball and football. So we had an actual college-level football. We had a Nerf basketball hoop, and we had a baseball to throw around. So we would have a lot of fun. We didn't play pig with our basketball set. We played ISS instead.
Well, how apropos. And I think one of the things when we see live video feed images or even the pictures of the space station, I don't think we get the size of the room that you're in. You mentioned about being able to play some sports. What is the space that you're operating in? I mean, size-wise.
Well, typically, a module's about 60 feet long with a diameter of about 15 feet, but that's reduced a little bit by the racks that we have to place inside the hull of the ship. So for the most part, you have a pretty open environment with four flat walls or four flat sides, and I would imagine it's probably, maybe 9 feet by 9 feet-ish, something like that.
So technically, we could put a bowling alley in there.
Oh, yeah.
I think
you probably could.
I'm gonna download my application right now. I'm headed there. having received cargo from the space shuttle and then of course ridden it home, even though the program was discontinued, do you think in the end the shuttle was fulfilling its role as a shuttle?
Absolutely. I think that as a cargo carrier, it was unparalleled. And that's one of the problems now is the parts that are going to start to fail on the space station, some of them are pretty large, and they needed the shuttle to be carried into space. And one of the difficulties we're running into is how do we really carry those parts back up into orbit? And we're relying on a lot of work by our international partners and some of the commercial companies to help us figure that out. So the shuttle was a workhorse. The shuttle was essential to the building of the station. It would have been nice if we could have kept it for a little while longer, but it's really hard to afford for our country to afford several different expensive space programs.
At least for the U.S., going back to ballistic shoots off of single rockets as opposed to the sort of the more complicated vehicle, the shuttle, whereas Russia has basically been stuck with the same kind of delivery system the same time. But now SpaceX has been slowly taking steps to do commercial delivery. They've had several successes now, and they're working on their passenger vehicle. What are your thoughts about SpaceX?
Well, you know, there are more companies than SpaceX, but I think commercialization of space is a good thing. I would like my children and grandchildren to have the same opportunity that I had. Of course, we want them to do it safely and successfully. It's not easy to put humans in space. We've been launching cargo into space for quite a while. That's a little less tricky to do and obviously a little less risky. So I think they're going to figure it out. I think it may take them a while, but all of the companies, SpaceX, Orbital, Sierra Nevada, Blue Origins, and Boeing, all of them are working diligently to help do that in the future.
And, of course, Virgin Galactic is looking to at least do suborbital flights and get the public involved.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that folks can pay $200,000 and hopefully do exactly what Alan Shepard did back in 1961. But, again, you know, he hasn't done it yet. He's working out all the bugs to make sure that he can do it safely because, you know, you have people's lives at risk, and making a mistake with that is not a good thing.
I wanted to jump back up into space again one more time because you've done a fair amount of spacewalks. And I think within the people's imagination, walking in space just is something that's really exciting to people. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I think you're in your own spacecraft. You're tethered to the vehicle by an 85-foot braided wire cable. That's the only thing that's keeping you from letting go and flying away. So it's probably, for me, the ultimate space experience to be able to do a spacewalk, and I'm very blessed that I've gotten to do six and spend almost 40 hours outside on the vehicle.
And I guess I could ask it this way. How much more involved is going on a spacewalk than, say, suiting up to walk outside during the wintertime in Nebraska?
They're similar. I think it's spacewalking is a little more complicated. I would liken it almost to getting suited up to play for the Minnesota Golden Gophers on a Saturday or something like that, or the Minnesota Vikings. You know, you have to strap on all your equipment. You have to put it on appropriately because that's what's going to keep you safe. But once you get outside, it's very similar to a football contest in that you have to be very mentally ready. And the assumption is that you've already been physically prepared to be ready. So I think the analogy is reasonable.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the most technical question of the interview. And you can admit it to me, you were the driving force behind the NASA Johnson-style parody, weren't you?
Actually, no, I wasn't. I was simply a bit player. It was done by the college education students that come here. They work at JSC part of the year, and they go back to school part of the year. And there's some very outstanding and highly talented individuals to put that together.
Well, you did a good job. I thought you danced very well. You picked up on the song and the dance and everything. And what do you think is? I can kind of see in the background. It's an obvious outreach to young people. What kind of reactions have you received as far as how it's been received by, especially the younger audience that would enjoy the original song?
I think it's been a really big deal. We have almost 5 million hits on it. It's the largest video success that NASA's done to date, apparently. And with today's social media environment, I mean, it was the perfect advertisement for what we do here at JSC and for NASA.
Well, Mr. Anderson, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We in about 4 hours, trivia 2013, A Space Oddity. It's 50 hours of questions, some about space and some about everything else in the world. So I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about something related to our theme. We really appreciate the time.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you. We're here.
That's astronaut, U.S. astronaut Clay Anderson, recently retired from NASA in January 2013. It was just last month. Mr. Anderson spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station in 2007. Then he went back up into orbit in 2010 on the spaceship or space shuttle Discovery, and he has spent 167 days in space, 38 hours and 28 minutes. Of EVA or spacewalking. So thank you very much to Clay Anderson. Stay tuned. More coming up in just a few moments. You're listening to KVSC's News Watch.